questions could wait. I didn't have the capacity to argue right then, and told him so. He instead had Ulrich's body removed by a couple of drudges, and sent the monkish physician to examine the two surviving magi. They would have other quarters to finish up the night, he promised, well away from the traumatic scene. I dragged Tyndall upstairs with Alia's help, drank a draught of spirits, and went back to bed, where horrible nightmares tortured my helpless soul. Ulrich's dead eyes stared at me, pleading, all night long. I awoke several times, screaming, feeling guilty about sleeping after such a disaster. But hells, what else was I supposed to do? Chapter 10. The Prisoner Speaks. The incident in Garkescu's chambers was later known as Ulrich's Rebellion, and grew with the telling, as such things do. While most of the particulars of the story, as it is popularly known, are wrong, the one accurate part of the magical folktale is that it marked the point where I started taking personal responsibility for the disposition of the witchstones. I didn't even realize it myself at the time. All I felt was a deep sense of loss, despair, and personal failure over the tragic death of a poor little boy. Needless to say, I didn't sleep very well for a while, though I was mentally and emotionally exhausted from the unexpected duel. Alia did her maternal best to comfort me, but the dreams were just too vivid, and that was a problem. When a mage's mind becomes that disturbed, bad things can happen. My proximity to the Irionite stones, and, I realized later, even the dust motes of the stone that I had blasted, interacted with my subconscious mind in strange and unexpected ways. Alia woke me twice when objects began flinging themselves around the room, and once when the temperature dropped to below freezing. I considered taking a powerful relaxant from my herbal inventory, but settled for another mug of strong wine. I insisted on examining Ulrich's body the next morning, over Alia's protests. She felt I had been through enough, and while I didn't really want to argue with her, I felt obligated to the poor lad. Sire Kusi, Sir Kay, and Garkescu came with me. It didn't take long to establish cause of death. Ulrich had died due to a massive arcane power surge to his brain, kind of like being struck by lightning, only from the inside. Such a thing isn't necessarily fatal, but his only chance of survival from such a surge would have been to channel it, much as I had to my fire demon during that first raid in Minden's Hall. But he had neither the skill nor the sophistication to realize that, or the time to do it properly. As I magically probed what was left of his skull, it became clear to me that I couldn't have saved him, even had I managed to get the rest of his stones away from him. On the contrary, it was likely the theft of the first two stones started the cascade that killed him, not the destruction of the third. By the time I blew it into dust, his brain was already burning out from the inside. It was sad. I didn't have the time, energy, or inclination to school Garkescu on how he ran his teaching program, but I think he found a valuable lesson in the experience anyway. He was down to one apprentice now, as Fenar was completely incapacitated. While he yet lived, there was an even chance that he would not live to see sunset. Whatever primal forces Ulrich used against his abuser had irreparably damaged his brain as well as his body. While we took a look at him, too, and did our best to make him comfortable and heal his more superficial wounds, his mind was gone. The senior apprentice was dead in all but name. While I can't say whether or not he deserved it, I knew we could ill afford to lose him. Tyndall and Rondal appeared to both be recovering, as was Garkescu. Ulrich had spared them for later, I guessed, after he had tormented his tormentor. I pondered the grim situation after looking in on the boys. There had to be a way to control the stones, or their users. Otherwise, they were just too deadly in any hands, mine included. Irionite had turned Oral Pratt into a maniacal killing machine and transformed a bratty little boy into a potent weapon of vengeance. The witchstones were too powerful, even in hands theoretically trained to use them. I started to see why the Magocracy were so paranoid about them, and why they had been banned altogether by the Censorate. Yet I had not gone mad, yet, I thought. A better way had to be found. How did the tree folk deal with the issue, I wondered. I got the feeling that the Aronin had absolute authority in such things among his people. But then again, the abuse of magic was not a serious issue in that wise and ancient culture. I was pretty sure that I knew how the Gavani dealt with it, that looming presence that was even now skulking its way towards us controlled the shamans with an iron grip. If one went mad, the consequences would likely be swift and dire for the transgressor. I discussed the problem some with Tyndall, who was good at bouncing things off, and even a little with Alia, once I got back to my quarters and assured them that I was all right. It was a surprisingly fruitful discussion between the apprentice, the farm girl, and the spellmonger. We discussed the ethics and responsibility of the Magi in general, and the important ramifications of the stones, and the place of magic in society, and a whole host of things that three commoners were not supposed to know much about. As it was mostly common sense we were discussing, it really wasn't that hard. But I'm sure we would have scandalized the nobility, had there been any about to overhear us. What came about, I will discuss in more detail later, but at the time, our discussions were interrupted by Sire Kusi, who was still in shock at seeing the full force of the stones unleashed in his castle. He seemed far, far more respectful of me than before, as if I could turn him into a toad or something. "Master Menelan, I know you have grave matters to consider, and I would not keep you from them," he said, after entering my quarters with a page. "However, for the last several days the keeper of my dungeon has asked about the disposition of the prisoner you took. Shall we execute him now, or did you want to interrogate him first?" It took me a few moments to realize just who he was talking about. Events had been too intense and severe for me to remember quickly. Then it all came back, the aftermath of the Battle of Lights, the fight with the Krynrok, the surrender. It seemed like years ago, not a few days. I blinked. "Well, yes. I would like a word with him. He's the only non-shaman Gervan I've met who speaks our language with any fluency." I didn't add that he might even be able to offer insight about the thing that was leading our enemies here so efficiently. He wasn't a shaman. He was a warrior. But he had to have at least a little intelligence information about his army we could use. The hideous events of the previous night had almost made me forget what dire straits we were in. Our days here were numbered, one way or another, and I had to face that fact before I could get around to restructuring the entire magical hierarchy and regulations of the five duchies, dealing with the invasion and other minor issues. But those facts also demonstrated how precious little time we might have left. In fact, I'll see him right now. The dungeons of Sire Kusi were small and, thankfully, mostly unused. In Bovol, after all, punishment for offences was usually meted out by fines, or, if unaffordable, as work detail, not imprisonment, and was a rare occurrence among the prosperous peasantry. But following custom, the knight had built a series of cells and a small persuasion room underneath the main dungeon, just in case. Currently the cells were filled with food and supplies, but there were a few empty cells available. My Gervan occupied one of these. Kusi insisted on sending a couple of arms men down with me, for my safety, which was ludicrous. They had the Gervan chained to a wall in heavy iron manacles, and if I hadn't proven I could take care of myself by now, I don't know what would convince him. I made the guards wait outside the cell and entered with the jailer, a small and polite man named Laron. He started to bring in a torch, but I knew the light would make the Gervan uncomfortable. I could use mage sight easily enough, and he would be happier and more cooperative in the dark than under the light and threat of flame. The Gervan raised his head when I came in, and to his credit, he didn't flinch. He sniffed the air a few times, then relaxed to his fate. I bid Laron to bring me a stool, which he did in short order, and then I began my interrogation. "My name," I said slowly, "is Menelan. I am a spellmonger for the castle. I am the reason your head does not now adorn the castle wall." The shaggy head looked up at me. Sighing, at least I think it was a sigh, the Gervan straightened a bit. "My name is Gurkal. I am second claw of the Bloody Fist Band. I thank you for not executing me.
I take it you plan on starving me to death.
I realized that it had been at least 4 days since his capture, and Laron, for all his politeness, had neglected to feed the prisoner or provide him much water. I summoned the jailer again and asked him to bring a goodly selection from the supplies we had captured. He slinked off to do so, clearly thinking that feeding one of our foes while we were under rationing was a fundamentally bad idea, while I continued my interrogation, which ran more like a conversation.
I am sorry. I had no intention of starving you. The jailer thought you would be executed in quick order, and did not think to feed you. I would have come sooner, but I was preoccupied with other duties.
Gerkal grunted.
It is good to know that you have not totally given up the famed human kindness in the middle of this war. Among my people, if you are going to kill someone, then we at least let him die with a full belly, so that his spirit does not come back to haunt us.
I managed a grin, despite myself. That's very wise of you. You earned at least that much by sparing my friend's life. Perhaps you can earn more. I seek information. He nodded slowly.
I thought as much. Shall we begin here, or do we proceed directly to torture?
Let's start here, I said. I'm not a torturer. And let's start with how you know my language so well.
That is not of any military importance, so I'll answer freely. I am originally from a clan of miners in the southern part of the Shulakava range. You call them the Mindans. My father and uncles traded ore from our mine to a human village in a valley south of here, near the land of Scars. I spent a lot of time in their village and even worked as a blacksmith apprentice to the smith who bought our ore for a year. I learned the Narasi language from him and his family.
He explained reasonably. I see. So why did you take up arms against my people if you knew how harmless they are? He laughed bitterly.
Harmless? Perhaps in your eyes.
We were interrupted by Laron, who delivered a basket of provisions taken from the Gavani camp. He had included an earthenware jug of that nasty, bitter beer they like so much, as well as a slab of freshly cooked bacon, black bread, and a bunch of the dried roots. Gerkal started for the basket as soon as he saw it, but was caught up by the chains. He sighed with resignation and sat back down. Release him, I commanded. Laron looked at me like I was crazy, but he slowly unlocked the manacles. I will ensure he does not escape, and there are guards right outside. The little jailer skeptically finished unshackling Gerkal and then left the cell in haste.
My thanks, spellmonger,
the Gervan said, rubbing his wrists.
In return for your kindness and generosity, I shall tell you everything I know. No need for torture, although I'm sure you'll get around to it eventually. You won't find it very helpful, I'm afraid. I was a minor officer in a unit of shock troops. I know nothing of grand strategy.
He dug into the food with the greed of one who has not eaten in days. I can't say that his table manners were impeccable, considering there was no table in sight, but they were no worse than the Crinrock, perhaps better. While he sated the aching in his belly, he started to speak his story in that gravelly voice of his, continuing to eat during pauses.
I come from a clan of miners. My clan had operated our iron mine for almost 100 years, spellmonger. What we did before then, I do not know. Our histories do not go back to a time when we did not mine that vein. I remember picking up stray chunks of ore, even as a pup. My clan lived in the tunnels we had mined before, and after 100 years we had a spacious and comfortable place to live. A clear spring gave us clean water, and the little hollows of soil nearby provided us with roots and vegetables. I was one of 4 pups born to my mother that year. My brother and sisters and I had a good life. Our clan's trade with the Humani made us wealthy, by the standards of my people. Our shaman was a wise old Gervan, who taught us the important lessons, how to read and write our language, how to dance our dances, and how to sing our songs. He told us the stories of our people, of histories and prophecies, and of our gods. My clan was held in high esteem by the other clans, and my uncle, the chief, Karza, was seen as a figure of great importance. No disease or misfortune befell us. We warred with neighboring clans from time to time, mostly over territory, food, fuel, and mates. But the battles were not fierce, and rarely did anyone die in them. Our warrior society was skilled, but they never fought another Gervani clan with iron. We used wooden clubs, and spared the victims as our slaves. When I was 10 years grown, which is the age of adulthood among my people, I accompanied my father and uncles on their thrice-yearly trips to the Humani village of Yescot, in a village to the east of our mine. My clan sold their ore to a Humani smith there, a huge fella named Bolo. Bolo had a big family, many pups, and a good wife. He traded us cloth and grain and such trinkets as my people enjoy in exchange for the ore. When I was old enough, my uncle asked Bolo to let me work with him for a few summers to learn his trade. He made me sleep in the barn, but other than that, he treated me well, better than his Humani apprentices. When I had learned all that I could from Bolo, I returned to the mines, where I built a forge and made tools for the clan. It was an honorable life. Smiths are highly regarded, under only shaman in Gervani society, and I prospered. For 6 years, that was my life. I took a mate. We had a litter, and I built a good home for us. But then, things changed. Among my people, Spellmonger, there are three types of shaman. There are the Golonosti, those who tend to the needs of the tribe, much the same way you probably do your Humani. The Golonosti are our teachers, our healers, our priests, our history keepers. Then there are the Ragonasti, the wanderers. They are clanless, moving from settlement to settlement, and trading news and songs and spells for food and lodging. There are Ragonasti who have great status among my people, but most of them are simple singers and tricksters whose magic is in their tales. Every clan likes a new Ragonasti to come. And then there are the Urgulnosti, the great shamans. They are the Gervani who speak for all clans, whose magic is their wisdom. It is said that they speak to the gods and see spirits constantly. It is a great honor for a clan to produce an Urgulnosti. It is rare that more than a dozen such live at one time. So uncommon is the talent necessary to triumph in the mysteries. One spring, almost a dozen summers ago, my clan was visited by one such Urgulnosti. He was an old Gervan, with long, grey ears and a roomy eye. He said his name was Horgu, and he preached about a new day. Our tales were full of the olden times, when we were the masters of all of Kalador, not simple mountain people. We sang of the times when legions of our folk fought the Furless, the Humani, for the right to live in our own lands. They were sad songs, wistful and vengeful, which they made. But we knew them only as songs. When he sang them, they moved many of us. Horgu vowed that a leader would arise like those of old, like Gurvos the Great, Grogoror, the War Master, and Sherul, the Great Shaman, and lead us to victory over the Humani devils. Devils? Oh, I knew your folk were no more demonic than my own. But the wars between our people have made you legendary figures of oppression. They are just songs to entertain us around the dawn fires, designed to scare our cubs and make them brave. But Horgu insisted that they were not just songs. He said that the Urgulnosti had worked a mighty magic, and that Sherul, who had been cruelly betrayed by the Humani and slain in the last great war, would soon live again. He said that Sherul would bring back the golden ages of the past, when daylight could pass over our sleeping heads without fear of Humani hunters taking them before dusk. He promised us wealth and prosperity for all Gervani, and high honor for all those who served in Sherul's army. Sherul, the great ghost, he called him. He told us to watch for the symbol of the black skull in the future, for that would be the symbol of the new army, the horde of the great ghost. I thought old Horgu a fool. Our shaman are skilled healers and proficient magicians, but they did not have power over death. They surely did not have the power to bring Shirul back from the dead after 200 years. I thought him a fool, but I kept it to myself out of respect for his age and rank. It was a good story, and it gave my clan hope. He left the next night to spread his tales to other clans. Horgu was not the last shaman to visit our clan. Over the next 2 years, a number of shamans came, dressed like Raganasti, but with the powers of the Urgulnosti. They performed mighty feats of skill with their magic, far beyond what our Golonosti were capable of. Warriors, who bore the standard of the Black Skull, accompanied them. You must understand that in our Govani civilization, there are many warrior societies. When a young Gervan comes of age, he must pass a series of tests and trials, and he is bid upon by the various societies. I was a member of the Bloody Claw, but there were also members of the Notched Tooth, the Impaled Heart, and the Iron Fist societies represented in my clan. They hadn't been more than social gatherings for generations. When we did battle with other clans, we fought as a clan, not by society. I had never heard of the Black Skulls, but I assumed that they were merely members of a society from a far-off clan. They came in ones or twos at first, then in larger groups. They were all mighty warriors who always wore their armor, real Iron Humani-style armor, and they always slept with their weapons ready. Even I was impressed. Every time they came, they encouraged our young warriors to enlist in the great army, away at Black Mountain, Korgol Vural, the largest of our ancient fortresses to survive the Great Wars. It is very remote, deep in the spine of Kalador. It is said that Korgol Vural was the last fortress Gurvos commanded to be built before he ascended among the gods. But I think it is older than even that, Great One. So it is a place of great meaning and myth among my people. The Black Skulls and the shamans were insistent. They encouraged all warriors to join the cause. A few did, each time they visited. I resisted. I had a family and a good profession and some moderate wealth. Indeed, since the rise of the Black Skulls, the other clans were buying more iron than ever, and I worked at my forge from dusk until dawn for weeks. Demand was so high that we didn't even need to sell our surplus to the Humani towns. Probably a good thing, in light of the evil stories the Black Skulls told of your folk, and what they did with the iron. Every year, more and more of our young folk left to join the Great Army. Even females enlisted, which was against custom, but the power and the majesty of the Skulls was difficult to ignore. Every year, the stories grew more and more fantastic. To hear it, one of the ancient generals had come back to life. Or maybe it was a god. Speculation was rampant. Those who scoffed against them were punished. I was wise. I kept my mouth shut and kept working my forge. Finally, about 5 years ago, a troop of the Black Skulls came by with the Mace of Garl, one of our holiest relics. It was said to have been the weapon of the Garl, the old god, before he was cut up in battle and made into the other gods. The Skulls said that the old god had been reborn in the Great Ghost, and it was time to take back the Sacred Valley which had been so evilly taken from us. We would use it to see the Great Ghost to the Cavern of Karmala, our lost, most sacred shrine. It was a token that could not be denied, and when they summoned all of our warriors under its shadow, I had no choice but to leave with them. I bid my mates goodbye, put on my armor and weapons, and marched with the other members of my society towards Korgol Vural. The next few years, I drilled endlessly in the massive caverns of the fortress, with thousands of warriors from every clan drilling with me. "Tell me about this great cavern," I prompted. Gurkhal grunted thoughtfully. "It is a massive underground fortress, deep in the mountains, the greatest of our works of old. Nearly 100 levels, it is said, a place where you could wander from chamber to room and die of old age before you could set eyes on all of them. The upper levels were our barracks, our training ground. The lower levels were the realm of the shamans. we were not allowed there. We practiced under the eyes of the great war masters and the Urgulnosti. They ruled our bands like tyrants, always making them stronger. When we weren't drilling, the shamans preached to us, preached of the coming new age, when we would once again take our birthright. They showed us their stones, the stones of power, and did great magic with them to show us why we would be victorious this time. They taught us the Humani art of war, the war of machines and swords and armor, not claws, clubs, and bravery. They spoke of the Arisen One, of Garl, the old god reborn, Sherul, the great ghost, who would restore us to our destiny. I went to the sermons and tried to stay awake. I thought the great ghost a mere myth. Unbelievers and deniers were tortured to death for all of us to see. I kept my mouth shut about my dance, but then I learned that there might be something to the legend. Our generals and our priests ruled over us, but they were not the true powers of Khorgal Varul. There was someone else there that not even the officers were allowed to approach, someone who was always surrounded by a dozen black skull bodyguards, a large figure draped with black cloth, round at the top, like he was wearing a helmet of great size. Once a Gervan from another unit approached it unbidden and was cut down before he had advanced 2 paces. That is our leader, I think. It might have been Garl, the old god. Perhaps it was Sherul, the great shaman. It might have been my Aunt Durga, too, under all that cloth. 1 year ago, after I had long become accustomed to life in Khorgal Varul, the orders came. We were to march. Lots were drawn, and the Bloody Fist Band was chosen to lead the second thrust against the valley. I was a good warrior, and had made second claw in the band. We marched for months through the darkness under the mountains. It was a strange and exciting trip. As part of the second thrust, we were supposed to provide support for the vanguard troops who were supposed to have wiped the Humani out of the way by the time we arrived. We were to garrison this castle until the next thrust came, then move on the mouth of the valley. If it pleases you to hear it, spellmonger, we were supposed to hold every inch of this valley by the last full moon. Your resistance here has thrown off the shaman's timetable. They are quite irritated with you, so I heard. Glad to hear my efforts are being appreciated, I said finally. The images I had picked up from his mind, through a little interrogation spell I had quietly cast, whirled around my head. The massive armies yet to come, the hundreds of thousands of war clubs prepared for human heads, the grim determination of the generals, the fanatical gleam in the eyes of the shamans, the glow from 100 or more witch stones, all of it pummeled my mind. But in the back of it all was the black draped figure with the round head, the old god Garl, as Gurkarl had called him, the great ghost. That was the focus of the magic. It was he, it, that held the reins to the rest. It was he who was making his way toward the valley.
So what will you do with me, now that I have told you all I know?
The Gervan asked, licking the last of the foamy beer away from his lips with a sharply pointed tongue.
Torture? Execution?
Maybe later, I said absently. Right now you are my only link to the Gervani. I can't throw you away so lightly. How far will the invasion go, do you think, assuming for the moment that I cannot stop it somehow? Gurkarl laughed harshly.
You cannot stop it, spellmonger. This is only one thrust, and not the best armed. Several more will come to this valley. There are more troops to the north and to the south, already making their way deep into human lands. Eventually we will burst forth and take the battle to you, wherever you might live. You may slow us here, but that is a temporary matter. The great ghost, the old god, comes, and so powerful he is that he can wipe this pile of rocks from the land with a thought. The shamans and the black skulls will not be satisfied until every last Humani is dead.
But why? And why now? And why this place? That gave him pause for thought.
How much do you know of the last war between our races?
I shrugged. Some, not much. The usual.
Your folk invaded our lands, and we drove you back into the mountains.
We were not invading your lands, Spellmonger. We were defending ours from Humani encroachment. My people had an agreement with your empire about where our lands met with theirs. When your tribes conquered them, they ignored the agreement. For years we struggled against their new settlements, fighting tooth and claw to keep our lands intact. Your people don't fight fairly, though, not honorably. You betrayed us time and again. In the last war, you not only betrayed us and executed our leaders under a flag of truce, but you took for your own our holiest of places, after you said you would respect our gods. Ha! Have you no idea what this war is about?
He asked incredulously. What holy places? I've seen the huts the Govani use as temples, and the stones in the fields, but
the shaman's huts? No! Not those. I am speaking of the lands given to us by our gods, places of great reverence, like the lake of Nara, where the mother goddess was inseminated by the mountain god, and the grove of Gilor, where the old god was born. There are shrines to our gods throughout this valley. But holiest of all is the cavern of Karumala, where Garl slew the five demons and later married the goddess Bireka, a cavern filled with silver and gold. Bireka's dowry, and holy relics, he said, eyeing me intently in the darkness. A cavern that now has a monstrous, blasphemous castle built over it.
It took a moment for that to sink in. The Gervani were assaulting this worthless province with unbridled ferocity, and this explained why. They wanted their lands back, of course, but there were better lands to be had within their grasp. Their attack made more sense if we were sitting on something else they wanted. Some place else. Some place holy. It also explained how Sire Kusi's family, House Brandmount, the lords of a valley with more cows than people, could afford to build a fortress like Bovol Castle, easily a stouter fortification as owned by any great baron of the Wilderlands. They didn't get it by selling cheese. They got it by stealing the accumulated wealth of the Gervani, which just happened to be stored in the cavern located, say, under the most defensible place in the valley. That explained why Sire Kusi had been so nervous about the prospect of invasion, why he was so adamant that the castle be defended, and why he had built the mighty castle here in the first place. He knew it was coming.
That bastard,
I swore. Let me guess.
The leaders of the Humani, back then, promised that your holy sites in this valley would be honored if you laid down your weapons. Then, while they negotiated with your leaders, a troop of men raided the valley and took control of those sites and your treasury.
The gold matters not,
Gurkhal countered, nodding.
The cavern held holy relics. Relics of our past greatness, when we were lords of the world and the Humani had yet to fall from the sky. It was the place where our most sacred mysteries were conducted. Your warrior slew an entire generation of shamans, and then looted our sacred places like the blasphemous bandits they were. If only we had been stronger, smarter. If the two brothers had not fallen by your treachery and might, then we would have avenged ourselves back then. But your people slew our warriors in their sleep and butchered our cubs in front of their mothers. I bear your race no ill, myself, Spellmonger. But my people owe yours no less than the blood we've spilt in revenge for those wrongs. It is why I am prepared to die now, Spellmonger, because I am the first Gurvan in my lifetime to come so close to the holy cavern of Karumala.
I'll not argue against your cause for vengeance, I admitted, suddenly feeling dirty. House Brandmount, Sire Kusi, this out-of-place castle, all made sense now. I could easily see why the Gervani were angry enough to raise the dead and build an army to retake the place. My indulgence lasted only moments, though. When it was interrupted by an explosion so loud, I could feel it even in the depths of the dungeon. It reminded me of the wave of power that Urik had unleashed, but I felt no magic around me. I whirled, thoughts of the horrible previous night filling my head.
What have those idiots done now?
I asked myself. What was that? I asked the guards.
That,
Gurkhal said sanguinely,
was probably the outer wall falling. We have been building tunnels for weeks now to drop that wall. We are a people of the mountains. Above all, we know how to dig. Perhaps you should go attend to it. Oh, and thanks for the meal. It really hit the spot, he said, with a sigh of satisfaction.
Chapter 11. The Mine and the Bridge. I cursed myself for my own short-sightedness as I raced up the stairs, the guards just behind me. I could already hear the screams of the victims, the alarmed cries, and the tumult of war through the thick stone walls, and I couldn't help but feel guilty. People were hurt and dying all because I forgot that goblins live underground. I had made an effort to erect a spellwork that was proof against sappers. There are all sorts of nasty things that you can do to someone when they're underground to break their concentration on their digging. But I hadn't emphasized those kind of spells, as I believed that the ground of the valley was too rocky, an eternal complaint of the farmers, to dig through easily. But this was war, and the Gavanni were familiar with these rocks. They were the rocks their ancestors preyed on. Tunneling might be a challenge, but not impossible, especially using magic. When I reached the surface, I realized that things were not quite as bad as I had feared, but not by much. True, the outer Bailey wall had been breached, but it had not fallen. In the northwest corner of the wall, a hole had opened the size of two wagons, taking a generous chunk of the wall out in the process. Gavanni warriors were streaming through, plying their clubs and swords against the peasants gathered there. It wasn't a slaughter. There were several dozen peasants, now part of the militia, who had grabbed their spears and knives and pitchforks, and were staunchly defending the stalls and tents that had become their homes in the last few fortnights. The sentries at the top of the wall were dropping stones and arrows on the invaders with some effect, but the defense wasn't organized enough to be effective at anything but slowing the advance. With a glance, I could see that it soon would be. Already the warriors from the inner Bailey were starting to stream out of the gate in full armor, swords, shields, and spears, fighting the dirt-covered goblins wherever they met them, and winning most engagements. Civilians and militia gratefully got behind the quickly forming line, and by the time I got to somewhere I could do some good, there was a kind of rough shield wall protecting most of the residents of the outer Bailey. The tide was by no means stemmed, but it had staunched the flow of goblins into a stream, not a flood. That being said, they controlled a significant and growing portion of the courtyard, almost a quarter. I had made a practice of wearing slasher if I left my private quarters at all, and before I realized it, the blade was in my right hand and my sphere was in my left, and I was looking for the best place to use them. The swords of the armsmen who had accompanied me were drawn as well, and with a wordless battle cry we ran toward the breach. There was no time for organizing an ordered defense against the unexpected attack. More soldiers from the walls and towers fell in behind me as we met the first of our attackers. By the time I got to the edges of the breach, a place where the Gavanni were still moving forward, I had about two squadrons of defenders with me. Our strategy was simple. The foe had come in and had to be driven out. I activated the war's magic spells I had hung to be more effective in that endeavor. The power of the sphere allowed me to increase my speed with a thought, and in seconds I was in the thick of the fray, slasher slashing and lightning growing thick from my fist. The next several minutes found me facing fanatical, furry face after furry face. The attackers were determined and deadly, as I passed a dozen human corpses along the route. I strove to be more so. My hands seemed to move of their own volition, as they do when my war magic takes effect. For me, time slowed to a leisurely crawl, allowing my sword and my spells to strike with unerring accuracy. There were plenty of targets for both. I didn't even bother with a rational defense. I avoided their clubs and blades, true, but I never parried. It was easier to just not be where their blows were landing. There was no conscious thought in the fight. Just duck, slash, leap, stab, dodge, blast, spin, kick, turn, smash, swerve, strike, and press forward, ever forward, toward the breach. I slew a score of goblins in ones and twos before I had made my way half across the courtyard, a dozen more after I reached the first row of tents and stalls being demolished in the fight.
Slasher was dripping with blood and fur, and when I had an instant where I wasn't killing someone, I sent a superheated blast of magical fire to burn the blade clean of the gore. Believe it or not, the weight of blood on your blade has an effect. It slowed me down. Removing it by magic, instead of just wiping it down, had the additional effect of blinding and terrifying a few of those goblins who faced us. It was interesting to note that they had chosen mid-morning to attack. I suppose that made some kind of strategic sense, catching us off guard, but it did seem to waste their warriors in a rather appalling manner. Of course, in a war of attrition, they had us outnumbered handily. The Govani I faced literally threw themselves savagely at every human they came across, armed and unarmed alike. Their fervor and dedication made more sense now that I knew that they were being led by a revived god and were on a genocidal holy war. I helped the few more die for their cause. By the time that I had made it to the outer edge of the tent city, reinforcements had arrived in force from the inner bailey, notably the Crinrock infantry with their grim axes. They matched the Gathani in ferocity, attacking wildly and with a casual regard for property damage or bystanders. They grunted savagely as their axes bit flesh, their war cries in their strange tongue at odds with shouts of Boval Vale and Kusi and Boval. The Crinrock stuck together, though, guarding each other's backs and pushing toward the breach valiantly. Their sudden appearance allowed those few women and children who had not been taken by surprise in the first attack to slip past their lines, and for that I was grateful. But that line kept getting pushed back. I glanced behind me to see that the Black Flag, minus their horses, were forming a more organized defensive line in a rough circle around the incursion, and a glance at the walls told me that more archers, led by the regular castle garrison, were filling the walls and turrets of the castle to snipe at the invaders. This made it more expensive for the goblins to advance, but whoever was in charge didn't seem to mind paying the butcher's bill. Tents obstructed my direct view of the breach, but I could feel the metaphysical tug of magic being hurled around at the base of the wall, bumping against our wards. I ran to the top of a parked wagon to see where I could lead the men following me effectively. My vantage point showed me that our foe had established a firm bridgehead inside the walls, some place that could be defended against counterattack. There were at least three shamans with witchstones, acting under the direction of a huge, nearly man-sized Gervan, in black iron-studded leather armor, and surrounded by a platoon of viscous little devils with spears longer than they were tall. Not all of them were fighting us. Others were moving dirt, stone, and bodies of the slain into a rough defense around the opening of the tunnel. But as I watched, more and more poured through the breach, fresh and ready to fight. The overcast sky made it easier for them, I suppose, and the Gervan general seemed to know his business. He directed the new shock troops with an expert hand to where they would do us the most harm, while the shamans cast war magic spells, mostly in support and defense, on behalf of the raiders. I tossed a bolt toward the general to test his defenses. It was neatly deflected. For 10 hour-long minutes, the action was furious as we humans fought desperately against the goblin shock troops. The screams of the dying, the wounded, and the merely terrified made it difficult for our valiant defenders to stay organized. But the arrival of the Crinrock and the Black Flag managed to stabilize the situation, if not contain it. After 10 minutes, the fighting had settled down into a rough battle zone comprising about half of the outer bailey. Any civilians that hadn't been able to escape were dead or dying, and many of the tents that had been their temporary homes were broken or burning. The advance had finally been halted. A semicircle of our men prevented any Gervani from pushing any further without paying a price, and our archers were using their shafts liberally from the walls and towers around them. Any goblins who made the attempt to push past the line, the Crinrock were gleefully slicing up. While our pet barbarians were making little real progress toward the breach, around which an increasingly tough defensive line was being erected, they kept it from hemorrhaging further. The knights from the inner bailey finally showed up, armed and armored, and took charge of the situation. Sire Kusi stalked up and down behind the lines, shouting orders and encouragement through the thick wall of smoke that was building up around the breach.
Sir Kay was in a tower, directing the archers to focus their fire at specific targets. Sir Ronsil was holding the strategically important section of wall between the breach and the main gate. If that fell, and the gates were flung open, the rest of the battle would have been over in a few hours. Despite the courageous rally and spirited defense of the Bailey, my heart was sinking. I felt like a sailor on a boat with a hole in the hull. I took a few moments to breathe, and let my senses fade back to normal while I assessed the whole situation. Things were finally stable enough for me to try to decide what to do. But what the hells was I supposed to do? How do you patch a hole when the water keeps rushing in? I was saved from the thought by a runner from Sire Kusi, who had spotted me through the chaos and sought me out. All councillors, he said breathlessly, were to report to the stables, which the Lord of Beauval had made into his command post. He particularly wanted to speak to me. No surprise. I nodded and stumbled in that direction. Along the way, I talked a scared little girl of maybe 10 out of a cup from the jug she was carrying. I thought it was water or wine or beer, but it turned out to be this morning's milk, still warm from the udder. Finer milk I have never tasted. I did my best to comfort her, and actually pointed her towards the southeastern wall of the inner bailey, where the survivors of the attack were being treated. I also laid a small calming spell on her, almost as an afterthought, as she couldn't find her parents. They had been living under a tarpaulin within a stone's throw of the breach. I told her they were probably waiting for her in the opposite corner, and to not be afraid. They were probably dead, of course, but no need to disturb her with the thought. I wished someone could tell me not to be afraid. My bowels had turned to water and my breath kept catching in my throat. Sire Kusi and his knights were huddled around a sketch of the situation laid out on a bale of hay with the help of a pile of rocks, horseshoes, tack, harnesses, and other equine paraphernalia. I nodded and leaned into the discussion about the defense. Sire Kusi looked up at me, finished his orders to an ancient, and then spoke to me harshly, fire in his eyes. "Spellmonger, it was your job to prevent something like this," he said, his mustached lip curling in disdain. "What in the name of Huin's axe happened?" "The enemy mined the wall and breached it," I reported lamely. The old knight shook his head in disgust. "First last night's debacle, and now this? I thought I had a war mage who could prevent this kind of tragedy. I thought I had a worthy wizard protecting my domain. Is that peasant wench of yours draining your wits as well as your sap?" he asked disdainfully. I let him live. To say I was taken aback is an understatement. I was shocked. His tone was imperious and ungrateful and entirely unwarranted, under the circumstances, and it raised my ire. Had I not done the impossible by wrecking 5 massive siege towers? Had I not built a magical core for his pissant little domain out of nothing? Where was the respect I'd come to expect from the knight? Suddenly, Kusi wasn't the noble figure I'd built him up to be in my mind. He was a bully in armor, with a title and a sense of entitlement. This little lordling and his miserable excuse for a homeland would have been carrion right now if it had not been for me. He had no right, nobility or not, to adopt such a manner with me, especially in light of Gokal's revelation about his ancestors' role in the conquest of the valley. The son of a treacherous bandit was deigning to be sharp with me, Minilan the war mage, who held now more power in his hands than any living mage. The crack about Alia was particularly unwarranted and ignoble of him. I might not love every woman I've bedded, but my budding relationship with one of his subjects was a sensitive subject, one a gentleman should have known to avoid. I could have burned him down where he stood just for that. I started to seethe, and my mood was evident by the crackle of green lightning that cascaded through my hair. I checked my ire. One effect I'd found of a mage maintaining close proximity with a stone for any extended period of time was his unconscious thoughts and emotions were occasionally expressed magically. Tyndall displayed it a little too, and he's a lot less level-headed than I. While this is impressive while you're having sex or laughing at a jest, I could see already that there were going to be some drawbacks to using Irianite regularly. It is easy,
all too easy, to let arcane power obey the whims of your subconscious thoughts, and let your feelings become reality. Had I been raised as he was, that's just what would have happened in that heated moment. I suppose the only thing that saved Sayakusi from being roasted to a cinder was my own upbringing as a commoner. All through the five duchies, the common folk treated the nobility with respect. They were richer, more cultured, and presumably better than us in all ways, after all. And to do otherwise could find you dangling from a tree. That ingrained deference alone allowed me to overlook this son of scoundrels and thieves while he insulted my woman and, damn it, just didn't appreciate me after what I'd done for him. Another peasant myth shattered, that good and loyal service is rewarded handsomely by nobles who are actually noble. The knowledge that 1,000 other human beings beyond Sayakusi were also in jeopardy intruded into my mind, and that gave me the strength to recognize the importance of not killing him in a fit of rage. I've often wondered since if I made the wrong decision. I chose my words very carefully, as the middle of a battle was not the best time to argue personal matters with one's liege. My eyes narrowed as I stared at him and said, in a slow and deliberate voice, "My lord, it matters little how they did it. The fact is, they did do it, and we must drive them out. I think they are contained for the moment, but come nightfall I'd guess they will try to break out in strength. We must be prepared. I suggest we firm our defensive perimeter around them, move as many civilians as we can into the inner bailey, and prepare to receive their charge." Venom dripped softly from every syllable. Sayakusi held my eye for a moment, startled at my tone, and realizing the impolitic way he had approached the subject. He grunted a sigh, then, as if I had stated the obvious, which I had, and turned back to his makeshift map. "Agreed. Let's double the number of archers we have on the walls, using the best of the peasant militia for that. I'll have Sir Onsil gather a work corvée to begin building a field fortification around the outside of our current lines, and include a small redoubt every 20 paces, if we can. Sir Kay can shift the tower ballistae from here and here to here and here, so that they can cover the courtyard. When enough of the fortifications are done, we can retreat our infantry behind them. I'll have the black flag break out more pikes as well, and ready torches and watchfires."
"A suggestion, sire?"
I ventured, acting as if it didn't really matter whether or not he heard it. The men around him looked from me to their lord and back again, seeing the stress between us for themselves. Not a good sign in terms of morale, but I was past caring. Sayakusi turned back to me, sighed again, and nodded. "As to the disposition of the troops, let's put the garrison soldiers and the black flag on the fortifications, and withdraw the Crinrock to behind the front lines until they are needed. The mercenaries and your own troops will be more disciplined in holding the line than the barbarians or the militia, particularly if they are using pikes. If pressed, the militia can reinforce the regulars. But if some Gervan really, really wants to get through badly enough, let them. Then close the line back up. The Crinrock will handle them."
"And how about our magical corps?"
he asked, a hint of a sneer in his voice at the term. "My men will do our best to neutralize the three shamans providing magical support. Doubtless there will be more of them there by nightfall, but we can do what we can. We can also provide defenses for our own troops. Indeed, I shall convene my staff immediately in my quarters and prepare contingencies. Then, my lord," I said meaningfully, "I will report back to you as to our preparedness, and inquire about our strategic situation, as well as speak of less pressing matters," I added, my mouth tight. Sayakusi raised his bushy eyebrows, and with a toss of his grey head, dismissed me without another word. I didn't bother to bow when I left. I was finally headed back to Talri to see my folks when I ran across Sayakusi from the long march in an inn in Innesby. I'd lost track of most of my old comrades from Ferris after the occupation, and it was a pleasure to encounter the old gentleman again. He was looking to buy copper and rye, sell cheese and garnets, and hire blacksmiths, masons, and carpenters to come to his enchanting little mountain land and improve his holdings.
He had a big castle, he boasted, and needed the labor to finish it. He was also investigating the prospect for a second marriage, his first wife having died with a fever, and perhaps one for his younger brother. We sat up late into the night. He was buying the wine, reminiscing, and after telling the usual number of war stories and acquaintances from the campaign, or the regretful loss of comrades in battle, he told me, in glowing detail, about the Valley of Beauval, where the women and the cows were renowned for their udders. The majestic views, the beautiful vale pastures, Himmers Lake, steaming fog in the morning's light. He painted a beautiful picture. Sire Kusi told me about his plans to finish his great castle, take another wife, have children. He was still virile at his age, he assured me, and live happily ever after. He told me of the enclave of tree folk and the idyllic existence his subjects enjoyed. He made it sound like a mountainous paradise, and sometime after midnight, and after way too many glasses of wine, I enthusiastically agreed to follow him back to his beautiful land and take a look around. Perhaps become a spellmonger, I mentioned. I was pretty sick of war magic at that point, and even more disgusted with my clientele. I longed for something simpler, more stable, and with better prospects of seeing my next name day. While he already had one in his domain, Kusi assured me that there was a need for another, and plenty of business available for an opportunistic young man. I was sick of warfare. I was tired of excitement. I wanted to find a quiet little place, leagues away from the nearest battlefield, and put my crappy career in war magic far behind me. Even by morning's light the next day, I stuck to my resolve. After 3 years of war, I was entitled to a little rest, a little peace. And idyllic Beauval Vale in the glorious Mindens was the perfect place to find it. It seemed like such a good idea at the time. I was studying the magical diorama, far more comprehensive than the hay bale map Kusi was using, when the rest of the magic corps joined me to plot how to seal the breach. Instead of just sitting in a corner and looking pretty, Alia stared out the arrow slit to the courtyard below, calling out corrections to the map as the situation changed slightly. She was as shocked over the suddenness of the attack as anyone, particularly since she'd lived in the Outer Bailey and knew everyone there, and the job gave her something useful to focus on. She had narrowly escaped the battle herself, having gone to visit her sister while I was in the dungeon with Gurkhal, and had just made it back to our quarters. Yes, I guess they were ours by now, I realized with a start. The thought was not displeasing, when the Gavani breached the wall. In a panic she had grabbed my bow and had lobbed a few arrows at them before realizing that she was no more an archer than she was a mage. By the time I had arrived, she was curled up in a corner, crying as she watched the chaos unfold. Her cheeks were still stained with tears as she called out corrections to our map. The others were almost as despondent, and it wasn't all due to the Gavani. Garkescu's face was ashen, and his hair had suddenly developed bright white streaks in it since Uruk's rebellion. The scrawny spellmonger paced around the tower chamber like a caged animal about to be sacrificed. His remaining apprentice, bookish Rundal, was sullen, silent, and could scarce drag his eyes from the floor as he sat like a sack in a chair by the diorama. Tyndall, ever faithful, was the most enthusiastic of my men. He knew the gravity of the situation, and had even helped in the counterattack. He had been practicing swordplay with the mercenaries again, and had fought beside the Black Flag, though only with a wooden sword. With two of our number gone, I'd have to improvise something within our power to do. That I had little idea of what that was troubled me, but I tried not to let it show on my face. I looked around at all of them and prayed to whoever was listening that the luck that had kept us safe from the goblins and our own shortcomings would continue for a little while longer. "Gentlemen," I began, clearing my throat from the smoke that was still thick in the air, "it has been a very rough few days, and I know we are all tired and afraid. I know I am, but there is no time for wallowing in self-pity. We have a situation that needs to be dealt with, by magic, and very little time. Come nightfall, we might well all be dead." Nods and stares. Alia started crying again, and then choked it off. She still hadn't heard from her family after the attack. This is the situation as it stands. Gervani have breached here, under the northwest wall, and have built field fortifications to cover a few hundred paces around that breach to prepare it for an extended stay. There might be 500 of the foes now within our walls, behind that line, and they will be reinforced steadily come dusk. Our goal is to stop the flow of Gervani before it gets that far, and assist in mopping up the ones who have invaded us. Arrayed against us are at least 3 shamans, perhaps many more on the way. They are well protected against direct attack, and our previous tricks are likewise warded against. I am open to suggestions, because I'm fresh out of ideas. Garkescu snorted disdainfully, and then looked away. But he gathered around the model like everyone else.
"My specialties do not include repelling invaders," he said flatly. "This is my first siege. I'm not fond of it," he added lightly.
"If only we had a giant dog," Tyndall said idly, as he studied the representation of the breach I'd added to the model. "It's like a gopher hole. Our dog used to dig them up all the time."
"More like an anthill," Rondal managed. "We've no way to know where their tunnel even originated.